This is George Newbern, the voice of Superman.
This is Kevin Conroy, the voice of Batman.
And you're listening to the DCAU Review, hosted by Cal and Liam.
Streaming at DCAUReview.com and on your favorite podcast app.
Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman. And that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Wait, he's very fast.
Yeah.
The world's greatest team of heroes has finally come home.
Home sweet home.
To Justice League.
Not so fast.
All them heroes is in the house.
Just watch.
Welcome, everyone, to the DCAU Review, episode 264. I am Liam, and with me, as he always is Cal. Cal, as we chatted about at the end of last week's episode, the Flash movie, the much maligned and turbulent Flash movie is finally just about to hit theaters in a week from now or so, less than a week from now. And so we thought to tie in with a little bit of synergy, a little bit of SEO for ourselves, we could perhaps tack on to that a little bit with a look at the character of the Flash, the DCAU's version of the Flash, that being the Wally West version, and thankfully a version that is a bit less controversial, shall we say, than the live action version for various reasons. But yes, we are here with yet another one of our character spotlight episodes.
That is right, Liam. We are tackling volume one of the fastest man alive, that of course being The Flash, as you mentioned, in theaters, allegedly coming up in the next week, provided no major PR, additional major PR issues occur. I feel like a certain star of the movie would have to kill someone maybe before they pulled it, but let's not wish that or speak that into existence. Let's just say, yep, it'll be quiet until this movie drops, and we will all be cheering the return of Michael Keaton as Batman, and all of the fun that will be had. The popcorn will be flying, and you know, all the nostalgic feels will happen. But speaking of our own nostalgic feeling, yes, we are going to look back here, starting with the very first appearance of the Flash. We assume it's the same Flash. There was never any differentiation between Barry Allen or Wally West in the suit. We know it's Wally West in Justice League. We assume it's the same in his initial appearance in the Superman the Animated Series. But yeah, let's even go further back as we talk about the origins of the character himself, as we break down the Flash in this this character spotlight episode, which of course is brought to you by the Pod Tower. Don't forget, if you like all things DC animation, check out the Pod Tower. That's the place for you. Head over to youtube.com/thepodtower today, where you can not only listen to great podcasts like the Watchtower Database produced Jump on the Batwagon, as well as the entire Tim Talk catalog, which they covered all of the episodes we're about to talk about today as well. You can hear their thoughts on those episodes. But of course, you get our entire catalog as well, meaning the episodes that we're going to talk about today, we've already covered, and it's all in one convenient place for you. Head over to youtube.com/thepodtower today.
Absolutely. So yes, we'll briefly touch on the character created, of course, this version of the Flash, the Wally West version. First appeared as in his Kid Flash guise back in the Flash issue 110 in December of 1959, created by writer John Broom and legendary DC artist Carmine Infantino, probably better known for a lot of his work on Batman. But character itself, as we always do a little backstory here, he was part of that era where, in the wake of the massive success that Robin had over the past probably almost 20 years by that point, every hero, if they were going to stick around, kind of needed a kid sidekick, and and so the Flash was no exception. Barry Allen's the Flash, taking on Wally West as his sidekick, and Kid Flash, of course, going on later to star in books like the Teen Titans and all of that over the years, all through the 70s and 80s, and then finally in the 12th issue of the legendary Marv Wolfman, George Perez epic Crisis on Infinite Earths, when Barry Allen gives his life to save the multiverse. Wally steps up and becomes the new Flash. And it's wild now because we've kind of, in the last maybe 15 to 20 years, have kind of shifted back to Barry being the focal point of the Flash universe, so to speak. Wally was just the Flash for certainly when we were growing up, all through the rest of the 80s and all through the 90s into the kind of the mid to late 2000s, while it was pretty much kind of accepted as fact that Wally had a much longer tenure than even some of those other kind of late coming 90s replacement heroes like a Kyle Rayner or Connor Hawke Green Arrow or someone like that. Like, Wally was the Flash, and I think for a lot of people now of multiple generations, certainly people to our age, both because of comics and because of the Justice League animated series, which we'll get into in a moment here, Wally is the Flash to them. And a lot of the characteristics they associate with a Flash character, the sort of jovial, quipping, lighthearted nature of it, come from writers like Mark Waid and Geoff Johns, and who worked with Wally over the years and kind of built him out into his own unique character outside of the shadow of Barry Allen.
Yeah, as you mentioned, we have a soft spot in our hearts for those characters that we grew up with. You know, I liken it to our parents' generation would probably, had a soft spot for the characters that that had replaced the grandparents' version of these characters. So
right.
Jay Garrick was no longer the Flash, it was Barry Allen. So yeah, every generation encounters that. You have people that are going to be endeared to those particular interpretations or versions of the character. But yeah, it has felt for a very long time to me, gut feeling, who's the Flash? It's Wally West. Wally is the Flash to me, to you, and to so many people in our generation. Mm-hmm. Obviously, when Geoff Johns took over and did the Flashpoint storyline, resetting a lot of the DC, bringing the new 52 into existence and all of that, that was all about kind of bringing back those heroes that he had more of a connection to. Hal Jordan being reset as Green Lantern, and Barry Allen being reset as the Flash, as you mentioned. But yeah, for our generation, even us who were not necessarily main continuity comics readers for a very long time, our singular exposure to DC Comics was through the DC Animated Universe and its loosely based tie-in comics. That was still our Flash was Wally, and Kyle was our Green Lantern. So he holds a near and dear place. Obviously, he's not gone. He's still a part of comics continuity, and I know there have been various different reincarnations where he was once again the Kid Flash, and I think there have been other mantles or various versions of the Flash that he's kind of taken on in the main continuity since then. But yeah, he truly is for all intents and purposes the Flash to us, and the fact that they went with the Wally West Flash for the DCAU is not surprising based on how comics were written at that time. You wouldn't go back in time and pull those other versions of those characters simply because it was you had to do the corporate synergy, right? You went
absolutely
with, you mirrored what was happening in the comics so that little Johnny picks up a comic book, he's gonna see Wally West in the Flash costume. He's not gonna come to the cartoon where all of a sudden Barry Allen, who was dead in the comics for over a decade at that point, or over two decades probably at that point, is the Flash. It would be too confusing for him. So you gotta keep that corporate synergy going.
Of course, very important. There's one thing that we will always stand by on this show is corporate synergy and brands.
We're big brands guys. That's our
absolutely.
I haven't done a new t-shirt in a while. I think that's we love brands is our the next piece of merchandise that you can pick up at the DCAU review shop.
Love that. But yes, Cal, we will get breaking into the DCAU appearances of the Flash, and it's kicked off with Superman, the animated series episode entitled Speed Demons, an episode which features the archetypal classic story that has been told and retold over the years in several different comics, several different mediums, in fact. The classic Superman racing the Flash to decide who once and for all is the true fastest man alive.
This is going to be great. Superman's going to shred that guy from Central City.
Don't bet on it, Jimmy. There's a good reason this guy's called the Flash.
Oh, yeah? Well, if he's so swift, where is he?
Sorry I'm late. Just woke up 2 minutes ago. Give me five, big guy. Too slow.
Flash, do you really think you stand a chance against the Man of Steel?
Man of Steel. Feet of lead.
May I quote you?
You could do more than that, doll. How about an exclusive after the race?
A fast worker, eh?
Just watch me. I'll run circles around this super slug.
Save it for the race.
And along the way, they run afoul of a disgruntled man with a special magic wand that allows him to control the weather. A wizard, if you will, who wreaks havoc not only on Superman and the Flash, but on kind of all over the city of Metropolis and all over the world as he attempts to sort of hold the world for ransom via this weather machine that he has, where the Flash, who I think in this appearance is a bit more one note, as you know, he's a guest star, he's not quite as fleshed out yet. He's very impulsive. That's kind of the theme of the episode, that he just wants to kind of go in guns blazing, whereas Superman is a bit more measured and is a little bit kind of put off and annoyed by the impulsiveness of the Flash. But ultimately they put aside their differences, they link up, they're able to stop the Weather Wizard in a good old-fashioned team up, and then for good measure, after dropping the Weather Wizard off in prison, they decide this time not for any cameras, not for any big events or charity. They're just gonna for the fun of it, as we end that episode, they're gonna decide once and for all who is the real fastest man alive. An answer that, as far as I know, we never really get answered officially, though most interpretations of these characters would give it to the Flash, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting because this was an idea obviously that did not originate with the DCAU. I believe Superman number 199 holds that distinction for the first. We're going to have a race between Superman and the Flash occur. So we go back to the late 1960s when this idea came to fruition initially, of the two fastest individuals on the planet having a race for fun. And but yeah, it is certainly an interesting episode. In my mind, this was like a season three Superman episode where they they started bringing in all of those guest stars, Aquaman, right, Green Lantern. But interestingly enough, this is very early on. This is number 17 in air date and number 22 in production number when it comes to this. So this is very, very early on in the run for Superman to throw in a guest star, which would then kind of set the table for them to be able to do this later on in those season three episodes, where you began to have those crossovers, or you know, you open up the world a little bit and you have the Kirby characters come in, you know, the fourth world start to show up. So yeah, it is very interesting. It's an interesting episode. You know, as we'll talk about in a little bit, of course, we have a different Flash voice actor for this episode. So going back in time, it is certainly odd to now go back and review this episode, as we did, by the way, which you can check out our review in the archives on your favorite podcast app, on the Pod Tower, or at dcaureview.com. This is episode, get this, Liam, 18. So way back there.
Jeez.
Yeah, it was quite some time ago as we tackled 264 this week. But yeah, if you want to check out our review of that episode. So yeah, episode 18. So it was it was very early on there, but it set the table. It is an interesting concept. I like the idea that they're doing this race for charity. The Flash's personality, certainly the quip machine, the ribbing, the arrogant, overconfident character certainly plays into this episode, as it would later on in Justice League. I feel like he's a little bit less of the... He's kind of like the Joey Tribbiani character from Friends later on in Justice League, where he's just kind of... He's very funny, but he's also very oblivious in a lot of ways that makes him out to be a little bit dumb sometimes. You don't quite get that in this episode, that he's dumb. He's just kind of arrogant and goofy in some ways. But yeah, it's interesting. Of course, ultimately, Superman and the Flash have to team up in order to defeat the Weather Wizard, and they are able to do so. And we don't quite get the answer because their race is interrupted, but then we kind of get the race commencing as we roll credits. So we don't quite get the answer that we're looking for, just who is the fastest man alive. But it's a fun episode. I liked, you know, obviously when we see this for the first time, we'd only ever seen Batman prior to this, Batman and Robin, obviously the Bat family. And then you get Superman, you finally get a Superman episode. And then now you're getting this character, the Flash, who, you know, we had the superpowers figures growing up, you know, you have the Flash figure, little superpowers Flash figure. You play with that, but you don't really ever get to see, you know, we weren't big comics readers, as we said at the time, as far as the main continuity was concerned. So you don't know a whole lot about the Flash. And this is your first introduction to this guy. You know, the Weather Wizard, based on, you know, some comic covers that we had seen with appearance in Detective Comics. So, you know, of the Weather Wizard, but now you get to see these characters fleshed out in action. So I think for those reasons alone, you know, you start to open up this DCAU world and involve these big seminal DC characters. It's important for that reason, and it's a fun one to revisit, and one we might revisit in the future, I'd say.
Absolutely, definitely one we joke on and off the air quite often about how many Superman episodes we kind of burned through in our early days of our podcast, and didn't probably give a lot of them the full attention they deserved. So yes, there may be some reviews in our future for episodes like Speed Demons. Certainly look forward to tackling that in more depth in the future. But moving on from there to our next appearance on screen for The Flash, it is, of course, the first season of Justice League, which will be running down the rest of that whole entire season for our volume one of this character spotlight here. And Flash has a distinction as the only member besides Batman, Superman, and Jean to actually be in all three episodes of Secret Origins, the pilot episodes of Justice League, because he's on like a little news interview in part one, where he's chatting it up as Superman begins to disarm the world's nuclear bombs.
Good evening. This is Snapper Carr reporting. It's been 6 months since Senator J. Allen Carter's dramatic disarmament plan was ratified. While Superman has been working around the clock to disarm hundreds of deadly warheads, public support for the plan has swelled.
Superman rocks!
Yeah! Yet some remain skeptical.
Hey, the big guy's heart's in the right place, but give me a break. I'm the fastest man alive. And even I can't be in five places at once.
Still, with more missiles being dismantled every day, most of us will sleep better knowing that Superman is watching over us.
And the Flash gets interviewed. But yes, we have the intro. A lot of moving parts in that episode. It's not really a Flash-centric episode. If there's one thing that does stand out, we do get kind of an immediate pairing off what would become kind of one of the beloved buddy cop relationships that this series sets up, and which, you know, is further fleshed out in later seasons in JLU. But we get our first GL and Flash pairing in parts two and three of Secret Origins, as we set up just the dichotomy of the no nonsense military man and John Stewart, and this sort of free spirit, quick to act, slow to think, Flash. They're kind of, there's that instant chemistry, the chocolate, the peanut butter and jelly coming together there with John and the Flash, kind of hitting it off, even though they're kind of butting heads immediately.
Yeah, you get the odd couple. It's the classic Hollywood trope of two opposites somehow working together to make to make a funny, interactive, hilarious team that play off each other, despite being completely on opposite ends of the spectrum when it comes to personality. So, yeah, that episode, obviously, I mean, we could go into detail. Another episode that we'll likely revisit for a re-review in the future, because we covered this episode way back on episode 30 of the podcast. So who knows, down the line, if we do a re-review month of Justice League episodes, you might hear us tackle that one since it was so long ago. But yeah, obviously his place in that episode, I think my main thought and memory as we originally saw that episode was, oh, we get the Flash, and this is the same Flash that we saw in the Superman the Animated Series. He sounds different, maybe looks a little thinner than he appeared in that, but... as we'll talk about once we go through the episodes, you know, he had made appearances in the Batman tie-in comics for Gotham Adventures. So we know the Flash is around in the DCAU, and now we know he's going to be a part of this Justice League. It makes sense. He has this pre-established connection with Superman, although I don't remember it. It's not really referenced from my recollection that they had this interaction prior, but people viewing know, okay, they had this race before, the Flash is around. You don't need to introduce him. We didn't really touch on that, but it's interesting that they, in Speed Demons, didn't even bother. It's not an origin story for the Flash. He's just there. He's already been established. He's a well-known superhero from Central City. So because he was already established in that series, you don't have to do an intro as to who he is. They kind of bring him in, assuming that you already know who the Flash is, which saves you some time from having to tell a story. Hey, Hollywood writers, take note. You don't have to do an origin story for every character every time you start a new movie franchise with pre-existing characters. A lot of people, it's kind of in the general public knowledge of who these characters are. You can figure it out. Otherwise, people aren't that dumb. So
absolutely,
I appreciate the fact that that Bruce Timm and the, you know, the people that worked on this show, James Tucker and Dwayne McDuffie and everybody that was involved with making this show, Paul Dini, everyone else, Alan Burnett, you know, that they didn't dumb it down to the point where they had to explain every single character's origin to you. The Flash is the Flash. He's fast. You'll pick it up if you don't get it. Like, if you're not aware who he is, you'll figure it out pretty quick.
Absolutely. Yeah, they drop you right in there. Other than Wonder Woman, really, none of our leaguers get like an intro. There's no 2016 Suicide Squad style, you know, stat sheets that appear on the screen to explain who these characters are. So, yeah, they drop you right in there. And very soon after, in the episode In Blackest Night, we pick up on the Flash's adventures there. Again, a very Green Lantern-centered episode is... John Stewart is on trial for apparently inadvertently destroying an entire world while trying to trace down a criminal. We, of course, find out later that it was all a big plot by the classic Green Lantern villain, the Manhunters, these sentient robots that are trying to take over the Guardians, take over Oa. Flash plays sort of a background role, a little bit of comic relief, but there is a moment where he does... ultimately, no, he steps up to be John's public defender, so to speak, in the trial. And even knowing that that he could end up facing the same fate as John for agreeing to step up and speak on his behalf, he still does. And he tries his best to sort of rally the troops to get Kilowog to go up and give John a character witness. And he does everything he can, but ultimately, it's only when Superman and the rest of the league sort of discover this hidden plot that Wally and John are saved, and they link up for their final assault against the Manhunters. But again, you deepen a little bit that relationship between the Flash and Green Lantern there.
Listen to me. With something this important, you've got to hear both sides.
Flash, I told you not to get involved.
They're railroading you, pal.
Hey!
Wait. This being may have a point. We don't want any lingering doubts about our final judgment, do we?
Of course not. But who would speak for John Stewart?
Don't you have any lawyers here?
We solved our lawyer problem a long time ago.
However, you could speak for him if you wish.
But be aware. If you lose, you'll share the same penalty as the accused.
The same penalty? You mean... That's crazy!
No, that's how we solved our lawyer problem. What's your answer?
Don't do it.
What, you think I'm gonna sit back and watch while you play martyr? I'll defend him!
Very well. Proceed.
Right, sure. But first, I'd like to say a few words about habeas corpus. Yeah, habeas corpus. And ipso facto, and Phi Beta Kappa.
Yeah, absolutely. He's the one that steps up, as you mentioned, is willing to defend him. That's pointed out later on by Hawkgirl that the rest of the Green Lantern Corps has sort of abandoned John in this moment of need. And his true friends, the people that later would become his best friends in the league, Hawkgirl and the Flash, are the ones that end up stepping up to do it. There's, of course, plenty of quips, some funny moments. We get the "if the ring wasn't lit, you must acquit" line, which, of course, homages the famous Johnny Cochran line from the O.J. Simpson trial. You also get, I remember just cackling the first time that I saw this episode when we get his reaction, the Flash's reaction to hearing why there aren't any lawyers that are willing to defend John. And that's because the lawyers also get the same sentence based on the fact, or based on whatever the outcome of the trial is. So if the defendant is found guilty, then the lawyer is also sentenced in the same manner. So there's some comedy that's played there. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's certainly a more Green Lantern centric story than it is a Flash story. But as you mentioned, it deepens that relationship. It shows that that the Flash has a heart and certainly values his friendships above, you know, his own personal well-being, as would be played out up until the very end of this of the Justice League Unlimited run. So we know that is something that they established very on, is his love for his fellow Justice League members and his certainly his friends.
Absolutely, yeah. So again, you just kind of setting up the baseline of the character. Flash would go on. Again, these Justice League episodes, generally each episode kind of focuses in on one character. So he does make appearances in Justice for All Parts 1 and 2, as well as Paradise Lost Parts 1 and 2, but it's not really a focal point of either episode. Some fun action sequences in those episodes of the Flash tangling with folks like Solomon Grundy and Copperhead and then the zombie warriors of Felix Faust and things in those episodes, but not a lot of character beats, so to speak, to talk about those episodes. Though I believe we did also review Injustice for All pretty early on in the show as well, if I'm not mistaken.
You are correct. Yeah, I did not mention it. In Blackest Night was episode 31 in the archives, and Injustice for All was 43 in the archives. Actually, our run from 43 to 46 were some of the who's who's episodes of the show. So yeah, 43 was Injustice for All, and then 44 is maybe the next episode we can talk about, which was Legends. You know, that it's in our top picks. It's mm-hmm. It's another Flash and GL adventure story with Hawkgirl involved also. And when we talk about my favorite episodes of the DCAU, let alone Justice League, this episode has to be in the discussion. It's just the travel to another dimension. You get the Justice Society stand-ins with the Justice Guild, and you get...
Speaking of, as we briefly touched on, other versions of the Flash, this is, for all intents and purposes, our look at a DCAU's Jay Garrick, so mm-hmm. to speak, with the streak.
There you go. Yeah, yeah. So we get our first sort of parallel dimension Flash. You know, I think they eventually introduced Jay Garrick in the Justice League Unlimited comics, maybe later on, the tie-in mm-hmm. comics later on.
But you do see his helmet in the Flash Museum in the last season of JLU as well.
There you go. So he's around, he's lurking, but this is the only screen time we get for that sort of classic original Flash character. So as far as the streak is the stand-in, of course, since they could not use that Justice Society characters for this particular purpose. But it's one of my favorite episodes ever. It's so heartwarming. I love the interactions that the Flash eats up living in this like stereotypical 1950s sitcom world of like ice cream men. It's like he went to Mayberry in the Andy Griffith Show and just he's embracing it. He's calling the classic Silver Age villain homages different names and loving Black Siren, who of course is a stand-in for the Black Canary. And he's not even asking the question of why they're there, what they're there for, how they get home. He's just embraced his role. He's just blissfully ignorant and happy. Like he's just enjoying being in the moment.
That's right. And we find out those little lightning bolt things on his cowl are pretty sharp because he pops a blimp with them. We get a little ingenuity. But yes, this also that episode, I would be remiss not to mention this is where the term that we often use on our show, a nuns and dynamite, comes from.
Mm-hmm.
There's a sequence where in the middle as the plot of that episode is every time the Justice League sort of comes close to figuring out what's going on in this strange world, some new crisis arises, including literally a truck full of dynamite careening towards a bus full of nuns at one point that the Flash has to spring into action to save. And later on, when they mention that anytime they get close to the truth, Flash says anytime we get close to the truth, it's nuns and dynamite.
Haven't you noticed that nothing here makes sense? Library books with blank pages, ice cream trucks that never stop.
Dangers that spring up whenever someone gets too close to the truth.
What truth? That your world is an illusion. A living memory of a civilization destroyed 40 years ago when the Justice Guild gave their lives for this Earth. That's why they stopped publishing the comic book in our world. No more Justice Guild.
And any time someone starts to figure things out...
Nuns and dynamite. If what you say is true, who or what is creating this illusion?
Perfect two episodes of television that Legends two-part of theirs, as you mentioned, and other episodes in this first season. We'll get to kind of the... We might actually... We'll do them a little bit out of order because there's really one main one to talk about.
Sure.
So we'll save that one for last. But elsewhere in the season... He appeared in, of course, Fury parts 1 and 2, which of course features the rogue evil Amazon Aresia unleashing a man killing poison on the world. Of course, Flash, along with the rest of the male leaguers, put out of commission by this poison, leaving kind of Wonder Woman and Hawkgirl left to team up and save the day and save the world at the end there. And then, as mentioned already, we already covered Legends. We have a couple other small appearances. A Knight of Shadows, parts 1 and 2, which is again more of a Martian Manhunter focused episode. There is a fantastic wacky sequence in that episode, which features the Flash and Wonder Woman going to like a Halloween party at what is a pastiche of the Playboy Mansion.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Hugh Hefner stand-in ends up getting turned into a giant worm that Wonder Woman and the Flash have to fight. it's a very wacky side quest to the main episode, which of course features the Martian Manhunter and Etrigan and Morgan Le Fay and all this mystical stuff. But in the middle of it, we just have this little wacky side quest where the Flash and Wonder Woman go off to the Playboy Mansion. So that's kind of a fun little side quest. And again, a way that we would see, I think, especially as it went on, where we could work in these little quirky character beats in the midst of these sort of epic and dramatic comic book action storylines.
Yeah, the Harve Hickman character you mentioned is the one that ends up being turned into the worm. The Flash provides the dose of reality. He's actively engaged in fighting all of this mystical magic that's happening in and around him, and not too afraid to point out the ridiculousness of fighting a giant worm that was was created after turning the smut salesman into him after being creepy towards Wonder Woman and any other female that appears in the episode. So yeah, lots of quips for that. Certainly provides it's just that characterization that we just mentioned in the Legends episode where nothing surprises him, and it's not in the way that Batman is not surprised. It's just he's embracing it and he enjoys it. He's like, oh, what, this is wacky, this is crazy, but I'm gonna enjoy it. I'm gonna be a superhero in the moment. So yeah, there, so much of that, of course, as we'll talk about, is comes from the vocal performances we'll talk about in a little while here. But yeah, that that episode of Night of Shadows, you can hear that. That's episode 45 on the podcast. If I did not mention it, Legends is episode 44. And I think we only have like two more first season appearance, notable first season appearances that we've actually covered so far.
Absolutely. And we'll mention there the season one finale of Justice League being the epic Savage Time three-parter. Again, not really a Flash-focused episode. A lot of the plot around that relies around, at least Flash's portion of that episode features, you know, John Stewart's power ring running out of juice and him sort of being left behind as Hawkgirl kind of makes the decision to save some soldiers that were in harm's way rather than going back for John. And so it comes down to kind of this back and forth between Flash and Hawkgirl of, you know, Flash completely incredulous, completely can't believe that Hawkgirl would leave their teammate behind, and Hawkgirl kind of having to point out to Flash that this is, you know, they're in a war zone and John is a soldier, and ultimately she made the choice to save as many lives as she could, even if that meant leaving behind, you know, this guy that they both in different ways care very deeply about. So that's kind of Flash's element to that, as well as, you know, getting to interact with the alternate Batman, the alternate the rebel soldier Batman, and then some of the fun of the action sequences of that episode with the Blackhawks and the giant war wheels and all that stuff. And then ultimately the Flash being the one to run across the ocean to alert the allies of this impending invading force of Vandal Savage's Third Reich army coming to surprise attack America, with Flash going to be the one to warn the enemy, to warn the allies that the enemy was coming there at the end before they all finally make it back in the end. It's like I said, it's not a big showcase for the Flash, but he definitely gets, again, some fun moments along the way in that three-parter.
Wait. This dude's picture is everywhere. Who is he?
You there. Show me your papers.
What?
You heard me. Let's see your identity papers now.
Sorry, but my identity's a secret. Chicks dig that whole man a mystery thing.
You think this is a joke? You're under arrest.
On what charge?
Out of the way.
Unit 295, we need backup.
No, absolutely. I think the part that stands out was the one that you mentioned, where he really goes in on Hawkgirl for abandoning John. We mentioned at the top his characterization of being an extremely loyal, caring, loving teammate is really his defining characteristic outside of the quips, you know, the comedy, the comedic relief for the character. So it is something that they established early on and continue to really hammer home, that he is loyal. If nothing, he sees the group as a family. You know, we see that later on in some of the season two episodes that we're not going to discuss today, but, you know, he really looks at the group. He's the innocent kid that just wants mom and dad, you know, he sees them, even though mom and dad fight all the time and don't agree on things, that they are the perfect family. They have the perfect marriage. Everything's going to be okay in the end. So he really does have this bright, sunny disposition when looking at things, but his sort of shock that Hawkgirl would leave John behind enemy lines without a weapon to defend himself is sort of the defining moment for that part one. And, you know, I think somewhat adds an additional dimension to him of not just being the quip guy. You know, it creates that idea that he does care. He does really see the people that he works with as more than just, you know, coworkers. He sees them as that familial type relationship. So yeah, you get to sort of again, deepen that relationship that he has with John, especially. And then, you know, it would not feel like a giant, you know, you have these giant battles that are taking place between the Nazis and the Justice League with the Allies. It would feel strange that the fastest man alive was not there on the ground, you know, him saving the different soldiers when they first encountered the war wheels. And then, as you mentioned, him playing this sort of Paul Revere in this mm-hmm. section of warning the United States and the Allies that the invading forces were on their way, so that they can meet them and send them packing, was only fitting for him, the fastest man alive. So, yep, it's a good episode overall. Obviously, that's one of the most legendary episodes, the first mm-hmm. three-parter. It's so well loved and appreciated. That one, episode 46 in the archives, if you want to check out our review of that one. Definitely worth a revisit for that one in the future as well.
Absolutely. And as mentioned, we don't really cover the Justice League episodes in exact air date order or production order. So we actually just more recently covered the last episode we'll talk about in season one of Justice League that we're going to be talking about today, that being The Brave and the Bold parts 1 and 2, because this is the Flash spotlight episode for this season. Not only does it introduce probably his most famous rogue, that being Gorilla Grodd, it's kind of a whole Flash centered plot where they kind of dig into the idea of him as this very impetuous, you know, act without thinking guy, and how ultimately, and in the end, he outsmarts the super genius to save the day. Again, you have that buddy cop relationship with him and John, but ultimately it's the Flash himself who outsmarts the smartest guy in the room. And you get to build that, even though he is kind of this silly, irreverent character, that he's got a little bit more going on behind the scenes than maybe folks give him credit for, and ultimately he saves the day here. But that's without a doubt the biggest the Flash showcase for that season. There's a lot of great homages visually to famous Flash covers with overweight Flash and Flash with the giant head and all of that, and some of the dream sequences as he's being sort of mind controlled by Grodd, and then the reference to JL Apes with him turning into a gorilla in the Flash suit at one point. He kind of goes through the ringer as he gets mind controlled all throughout part one of that episode, and you're kind of putting together the mystery while also explaining this wacky Gorilla City concept. And then ultimately in part two, as the rest of the league kind of deals with these missiles that are being fired towards Gorilla City with GL, and then the other Justice Leaguers on the ground in Gorilla City trying to stop them. In the meantime, it comes down to just the Flash and his benevolent gorilla pal Salazar, as they have to face down Grodd on their own, and Flash rises to the occasion. So it's a fun little episode to maybe not only do a bunch of fun Flash stuff and homages to stuff from the Flash comics over the years, but ultimately also, you know, deepen the character a little bit more to see that, you know, he's not the smartest guy on the team, but he's not a complete idiot either. Like he's not so one-dimensional as maybe he seemed when we first meet him.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can check out that one. That was we actually reviewed that back in August of last year on episode 221 of the podcast. We did a full month of Flash episodes last month, thinking that we were never going to get the release of the Flash movie. But here we are. We've adapted. But yeah, that episode is so fun for so many different reasons. You know, that episode was penned by Rich Vogel and Paul Dini. Paul Dini apparently, as the story goes, had some sort of hand injury and couldn't finish it. So that's when they actually tapped Dwayne McDuffie in to complete mm-hmm. the writing. So he gets a teleplay credit on there. And ultimately, that sets the stage for what would become some of the best writing of the entire series, as they involve Dwayne McDuffie in the, you know, later seasons of Justice League and Justice League Unlimited. So for that reason alone, this episode is extremely important. But yeah, you get the comedy, the Paul Dini comedy elements in the episode as well. And, you know, you set up Gorilla Grodd's introduction here, Gorilla City, and everything that comes with that, which would come into play later on, not only in season two of Justice League, but then, as we mentioned, a huge part of that final season of Justice League Unlimited. So yeah, so many important parts of that, but the Flash's role in that, as you mentioned, it really, really is a Flash and Green Lantern story. It does do a better good job of fleshing out the Flash as a character, showing his place in Central City, him and Green Lantern even get the buddy cop version as they're sitting there like at a cafe or at a burger joint eating food after they've been on patrol. So you get a lot of fun, interesting elements here and fleshing out of the characters, but it's a great episode. Again, highly recommend checking it out. We just did that one in the last 6 months or so. So if you have not checked that one out, that's a fun one to go back and revisit in the archives.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It's a lot of fun. That first season of Justice League, I think as we look back on it, especially now, it's because so much great stuff comes later in the second season and then certainly in JLU, I think the first season of Justice League can be looked at. It's a little more shaky. They were certainly still finding their footing. As mentioned, bringing on writers like Dwayne McDuffie certainly helped find their way. I think certainly by the end of season one and into season two, they're beginning to find their way a little bit more. But yeah, I think that episode is a good example of one. That's an episode we saw a lot when we were kids, and it's certainly one that I think holds up, that I think of pretty fondly as a fun episode to go back to now. But that will wrap up the televised portion of Volume 1 of our Flash Character Spotlight here, Cal. However, as we always do, we will look at some of the merchandise as well as some of the tie-in comics that go along with it. And funny enough, the Flash, his first DCAU appearance is in Superman, and then his next DCAU appearance is not technically in Secret Origins Part 1. It's in Batman Gotham Adventures number 25. Written by Scott Peterson with art by Tim Levins. And the thing that stands out to me there is I believe it's a Rick Burchett cover of Batman sort of standing very, very stoically as the Flash kind of speeds all around him. But the idea of seeing sort of these, as we always talk about with the tie-in comics, these extra little stories that didn't quite make it onto TV, but that feel like they fit in that universe. Always fun to see Batman of all people tasked with a superpowered hero to work with here. And so seeing the Flash and Gotham Adventures was quite a bit of fun at that point. And from there, of course, we also have a couple of issues of Justice League Adventures where the Flash was the star. We have Justice League Adventures number 7, written by Len Kaminsky with art by Joe Staton. That is the episode that might be one of my most memorable issues of that tie-in comic. First of all, it has a very memorable Darwin Cook cover on it. And then you have the Flash. In order to try to stop a alien invasion, he sends himself through a fax machine to stop them, which inadvertently flattens himself out, makes himself two-dimensional, but ultimately he saves the day because he's the only person who can see these invading two-dimensional characters, these aliens. It's a really silly, silly issue, but pretty memorable.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that. I know exactly the cover that you're talking about. I can see it in my head, two-dimensional Flash running around. As you mentioned, a great cover from the late great Darwin Cook. But then the whole concept of the fact that he's two-dimensional after setting himself through a fax machine and can therefore only see these 2D characters that are invading. What a ridiculously funny it fits well because it's a comic book. If this was an episode of a television show, we'd be scratching our heads and going, "What in the world is this?" But because it's a comic, it works well. It's certainly a goofy issue, but certainly memorable. Like, I remember it. I remember what it looks like. I remember what the 2D aliens look like just from the prompting. So I think they did their job there.
Absolutely. And then the last one we'll mention is couple issues later in Justice League Adventures number 9, written by Matt Howarth with art by David Lopez. Sort of a fun little, a bit simpler of an issue here with the Flash, Wally West. This was actually, I think, technically, although, as we know, the tie-in comics, not always, they don't always fit neatly into the DCAU canon, as we've talked about, as we regularly talk about, certainly with, say, Batman The Adventures Continue, which we review in our bonus episodes quite often. But we have Wally West out for a night on the town on a date, but having to constantly leave to do various adventures as the Flash, kind of constantly being called into action. It's a fun, cute little issue. And speaking of DCAU legends, it's got a pretty fun Butch Lukic cover on it. It has this sort of painted aesthetic to it, but it's a fun little issue as well there, as we will wrap up the comic portions and get into maybe what is one of our favorite parts of the Character Spotlight episodes, Cal, which is the figures. And that original Mattel Justice League line, as mentioned, not a lot of villains in that line. So we got quite a few releases of that original Flash figure.
Yeah, you have, I think, the standard yellow. They came back later on with like a goldish version. I will say it's the first, I think it was the first Justice League animated figure that I got, from my recollection, because at that point you have a Superman figure, you have a Batman figure. You know, why would you wouldn't necessarily need another one of those. So if you're in the toy store, you're at Toys R Us, and your parents are offering to buy you a figure, which one are you going to pick? You're not going to get one of the ones you already have. You're going to get somebody that you don't have. So the Flash, of course, being one of the first opportunities to snatch one of those, I grabbed it as soon as possible, but with the standard yellow boots. But yes, as you mentioned, they certainly captured the likeness. It's one of the best. I mean, the original seven figures that they dropped look like miniature versions of the maquettes that they released for the Justice League. And it's impressive. It's a very, very, very impressive figure, especially for a 4.5 or 5 inch, I guess at a 4.5 inch figures. So it's impressive. It captures the likeness perfectly. He's kind of got the little Flash smirk on his face. You know, the colors were maybe a little too muted on the original release. He doesn't quite have the bright crimson red on the costume that would be later corrected in some of the subsequent releases. It was also hard. He has got 5 points of articulation, so his arms can move up and down, his legs move up and down, and his head moves, but can't really get him into a running pose, so he's just kind of standing there. So you kind of had to use your imagination a little bit more than you would have done so with some of those later releases, where they allowed you to bend his arms and legs. But it definitely captures that Bruce Timm style of artwork. Certainly looks like the model sheet, whoever was responsible for the Flash model sheet, captured perfectly in this three-dimensional form. So hard to beat that version of the character. But again, they did some re-releases, as you mentioned, where he had some extra gear added on, and part of the Mission Vision line where he had some like space stuff added on. And then you have the twin Turbo Deluxe figure, which is just an excuse to get mom and dad to pay an extra $3 or $4 for some plastic accessories that don't make too many sense. But you also had the, I think, which to me are the maybe most underrated and best captured the likenesses, and that's the 10 to 12 inch line of Justice League figures that they put out at the time that were based on the original Warner Brothers maquettes of these characters. And that whole original seven that you can get just are absolutely perfectly capture the animation form of these characters, and that Flash figure is no exception. It's perfect. He's a little bit shorter than Batman and Superman, so he kind of fits in there well, stands well. You can only move his arms, but those particular figures were not meant to be like super played with. They're just kind of there to stand and look cool. So they're an excellent part of anyone's display, if you ask me. But that wouldn't be it, as even within the last 5 to 10 years, I guess 5 years. I know they did do some Justice League maquettes at some mm-hmm. point. DC Direct did maquettes of the original seven. They had the mail away. I guess it was a subscription service where you got these little tiny statues based on the Justice Leaguers. So these little, they're like 3 inch tall or so. I think you have a couple, actually. I may have gifted
For my birthday, you got me quite a few of them.
Yeah, so you have the Flash in there as well. It's mm-hmm. again, these are just little display pieces, not meant for actual playing or much action displays. But you did have the DC Collectibles did on their deathbed, originally directly only available through the DC Universe streaming app, the best streaming app in the world, in my humble opinion. It's a wonderful app, but originally available only through there. They did a line of the original seven Justice Leaguers, so you had the Flash there. Mm-hmm. That one, it was plagued. That whole line was plagued, unfortunately, with some poor construction. It looked like they did a lot of cost cutting. This was, of course, the time they were doing the Batman the Animated Series figures, which have stood the test of time with multiple hands and expressions and all of that. This line got cost cut at the very last minute, it looks like. So while you can take hands off, there were no subsequent hands. And he's kind of standing awkwardly with his elbows kind of paired in towards him. So it's not the best. It could have been one of the better figures. They didn't quite capture the likeness on the head either. It looks a little goofy, to be honest. And then I think most recently we actually had the very first ever release of what was supposed to capture his appearance in Superman the Animated Series, as McFarlane did a DCAU Flash figure. Mm-hmm. And on the packaging it says Superman the Animated Series. So we get that Speed Demon's appearance, at least in the interpretation of the sculptors at McFarlane.
I was going to say the big glaring things for me with that McFarlane release are he doesn't have on the Superman costume. He has like the black rim around the lightning mm-hmm. bolt and mm-hmm. black circle instead of a gold one, mm-hmm. which they did not put on the figure. He just has it's a pretty solid Justice League Flash, ironically.
Sure. Yeah.
But they chose to call it a Superman the Animated Series Flash. And also in that Superman episode, one of his little ear things, do we have a name for those?
Pikes. I don't know what they're called. No, they're not pikes. Yeah. Ear pendants? No.
Yeah. Maybe pendants, but whatever those things. One of them is just white the whole time for uh-huh. some reason in that episode. It's really distracting. I remember that. Watching some clips of these episodes to get ready for this. I was like, oh, right. His one pendant is just white in every shot for some reason.
Very strange.
But yeah, so it's not a direct recreation, but it's a, like I said, it's a good DCAU Flash figure. It's just ironically not the Flash costume that they're supposed to be depicting.
Right. Yeah. Very odd choice. So. Now we know that McFarlane has re-released some of the Batman the Animated Series figures, so who knows, maybe we'll get a re-release with some of those corrections of the DC Collectibles versions, or who knows down mm-hmm. the line. But I would say that the last thing that we have to talk about, Liam, ironically also links to the Superman the Animated Series, and we talked about how that McFarlane figure was the first official depiction, but thanks to the Instagram account at Toy Otter, we had pictures of an unreleased Kenner Flash figure that was supposed to come out during the 97 Kenner run of the Superman the Animated Series figures, and the folks at Toy Otter posted this. Check them out on Instagram, head on over there. They're doing their own toy figure line right now that you can go and take a look at, but I would say maybe a year or two ago they did this series of posts about all unreleased toys and action figures, showing prototypes and designs and things that just will absolutely blow your mind. It was every single day there was something new, and it goes all the way from Superman and Batman figures, as we mentioned, to you know, other properties, you know, that are just going to absolutely blow your mind. So if you don't follow them, check out Toy Otter on Instagram, if that's your jam, because they blew our minds with the reveal of this, what was supposed to be a Flash figure, and revealed mm-hmm. that there was also going to be other figures, perhaps a Dr. Fate and an Aquaman figure for the Superman series that also never saw the light of day. But we got to see actual pictures of a prototype figure. And while it didn't follow the Bruce Timm sort of clean lined, straight boxy look, and certainly fit more into those figures at the time, the Total Justice ab bearing action figures with defined muscles, I couldn't help but think, man, I would have killed to have had this figure in 1997 Ooh. Or 98 to play with my superheroes.
Absolutely. Yeah. It would have been a great, great piece for the collection. Cause it's funny. We were just talking about how the Justice League line didn't feature a lot of, you know, non Justice League characters in it. Not a lot of villains in those sets. And it would have been nice to have filled out that line a little bit more. And the same way of Superman, a lot of alternate repaints of various Kenner Superman made it into those sets. And then you did thankfully have more villains, fleshed out in that series with Brainiac and Luthor and Bizarro and Metallo. But yeah, you, if you had one thing to miss, especially as mentioned, as the show went on and you got the Flash, you got Green Lantern, you got Aquaman, you had Dr. Fate, like all these sort of guest characters that rolled into the series, it would have been really cool to get a few more of those animated versions of the characters in that Kenner line. It certainly would have been a godsend to us as kids playing with them. So we didn't have to keep mixing in our, our Kenner, Death of Superman Steel and our Total Justice Flash and all of those with our DCAU figures. It would have been pretty great to get those animated versions back then. But absolutely, that's a really fun find. As mentioned, at Toy Otter on Instagram posts a lot of historic and sort of lost prototypes and things on their page from time to time. And yeah, seeing that pop up, it was a real brain wrinkling moment of, oh my gosh, what could have been with that Kenner line.
Yeah, it was super fun. Definitely check them out. And make sure you tweet at us or send us a message on Instagram if you had any of these figures when you were growing up. As we mentioned, we had to use the Total Justice Flash for a very long time for our DCAU Flash until the Justice League line hit. So yeah, lots of good representation, especially of this particular incarnation of the Flash. I think if I had to pick my favorite, as I mentioned at the top, it's hard to beat those 10-inch figures just because they capture the likeness so well, even if you're not playing with them nowadays as a display piece. Think about it. Those were like, I think at the time they may have been $15, maybe $12 to $15 figures. Shoot. And you're basically getting what nowadays, if you had to pay for that representation of those characters, you know, and let's just say even in PVC form, I think I'm pretty sure Diamond Select charges like upwards of $50 to $60 for plastic maquettes now. So, you know, at the time, and you can still pick them up, they're pretty relatively inexpensive. So they're a good focal point for a DCAU collection or a Justice League animated collection, or even if you don't have a particular collection, you just want good representation of the Flash. It's a great piece and it's probably my favorite. You got a favorite to pick?
Yeah, I'd probably just go with that original Justice League Mattel first one there. I think it's just because that's the one I remember playing it so much that the joints got loose and and thankfully, you know, we'll get to those JLU lines down the road, but eventually we had more Flashes and Supermans and and Batman than we knew what to do with when it came to, because of those three packs that came out in the JLU lines. But yeah, at the time when we first got a hold of that original Flash from the first series, where, you know, each character except for Hawkgirl got a release, and they all had the interconnecting stands that came with the figures. So lining them all up together with that Flash was pretty good. So that's kind of the one that sticks for me. But yeah, those 10-inch ones are immaculate. Like, it's It's something that like it's very similar to the statues they made for the Warner Brothers Studio Store. You actually got me the Tim Drake Robin one for a gift a few years ago. Just very clearly, very directly modeled off of like the model sheet and just done at such a high level of quality for what was a retail shelf doll at the time. It's just. Yeah, you're not going to see that level of quality in a figure that size for that price point ever again. So, yeah, hard to beat those 10-inch ones as well. And I think we touched on them briefly, but as we begin to wind down here, Cal, we'd be remiss not to mention the voice actors behind the Flash. And of course, most famously, we have Michael Rosenbaum, Lex Luthor himself in Smallville and several other projects, podcast aficionado now. But first up, we had Charlie Schlatter as Flash in Superman the Animated Series, and he does a solid job. Like you said, we will perhaps go back and revisit his performance in more depth in a future episode. But obviously, again, as we've just been talking about for the last hour or so, Michael Rosenbaum's voice, being cast by, had done plenty of voices in Batman Beyond. We talk about that a lot, where we'll come across a famous or familiar voice in a role before they got the role that everybody knows them for in these cartoons. So you can hear Rosenbaum a lot in Batman Beyond and the Zeta Project before ultimately he landed sort of the perfect role for him that Andrea Romano and Bruce Timm and the rest of the producers on the series found for him, that being the Flash, where he becomes, I think, along with Phil Lamar as John Stewart and Susan Eisenberg as Wonder Woman, he gets to sort of make a new character for that series, that and ultimately and very quickly sort of becomes the iconic voice actor for that character, where it's a hard act to follow, I think, as anyone who has voiced the Flash since probably knows very well. So, needless to say, we sing his praises quite regularly on the show, so we don't need to go too in depth, but we'd be remiss not to mention just like the element of that playful and energized nature that Michael Rosenbaum is always, as talented of an on-screen actor as he is, was kind of just born to be a voice actor as well. And it's as we've talked about, not every television or film actor can transition to voice acting and vice versa. So somebody as versatile as him finding that role and just excelling in it is always fun when we get to talk about a Rosenbaum Flash episode.
Yeah, it's he's one of the, he's in the discussion for going on the Mount Rushmore of voice actors for sure for the show. Mm-hmm. He defines the character. I think we touched on, as we kind of talked about the individual episodes, but there's not, with the exception of maybe Brave and the Bold, there's not one particular episode where he carries a lot or is asked to carry a lot. So you get that later on, certainly fleshed out in Justice League Unlimited as he became more of the focal point later on. But yeah, it's for what's asked of him, he's asked to be a comedic relief at times, while also still balancing it, the fact that he is a superhero on a show that is majorly for the majority serious. So he does provide that lighthearted nature. He does is able to kind of switch back and forth. Like, he does have that characterization of being serious. That whole, his whole persona in the Savage Time is he's not like cracking wise and having a whole bunch of quips after he realizes the serious nature of the mission that they're on. Once he realizes they're back in time and the Nazis are winning, it's pretty much all business for the most part. So yeah, he's unsurprisingly a very dynamic actor. He's a bit an incredible part of the DCAU for the various different roles that he played, but this being his defining role, he is the Flash to me, to you, to so many people. So yeah, it's unsurprising that we're gonna heap loads of praise on him in this forum. But what else can you say? He's really good. He does his job. He provides the comedy that's necessary. And this is at a time where he was also playing the serious Lex Luthor character on Smallville, as you mentioned. So it's to be able to differentiate and be able to be that super serious, mean, villainous character on television if you're watching Smallville, but then you come here and he's able to put on a completely different tone and come across, and not, there doesn't seem to be any bleeding or crossover. Like, there's no confusion of character in my mind. Like, they're two separate people. They're two separate characters. It's not like, oh, that's Lex Luthor, or oh, that's Flash. And they would play upon that later on, obviously. But yeah, he's really good. We could talk about this for another 20 minutes, but we won't.
Yeah, we'll have to save some additional Rosenbaum praise for future episodes of Justice League and JLU, as well as, of course, the next volume of the Flash character spotlight. And as we get closer to wrapping things up here, Cal, we will touch briefly on the music. There is sort of a brief Flash theme. It doesn't feel like there's one consistent theme throughout the series the way there is for a Green Lantern or Wonder Woman, or certainly not Superman and Batman, which, you know, follows those characters through multiple series. But there's kind of a Flash theme that plays. It's actually got some of the earliest adoption in Justice League, at least, of electric guitar music brought in by our dynamic music partners of Lolita Ritmanis, Christopher Carter, and Michael McQuistion. I think you can hear it pretty evidently in the not only in Brave and the Bold parts 1 and 2, but it's kind of brought back in the episode of season 2, Eclipsed, as well. There's kind of a little bit of a rocked out theme for the Flash, usually when he's in a bit more of a chase sequence going on, which certainly that happens quite a few times in Brave and the Bold. So not necessarily the most identifiable theme that I think we have. And part of that also goes back to not all of the music of Justice League and JLU has been released on its own soundtrack. So it's a little bit harder to always parse out a theme for that character when it isn't maybe as obvious. But there's, I feel like it's more of a Flash's theme is more of the tempo than it is like the actual notes being played. There's a certain, it's more of the vibe and the speed of the music that comes in with Flash.
Yeah, it sets the tone for the frantic nature of the character, the speed, the drums, the percussion, the bass line. It's definitely more bass and drum driven than it is melodic, which is certainly a departure from, as you mentioned, the more notable themes of the series. But yeah, it's a fine piece. It's funny, we were in the preparation for the episode, we pulled it up and listened to the composition, and I told you, it's like, I think if this hadn't been available on YouTube to listen to, I don't think I could have identified a Flash theme, because it was not the focal point of a lot of episodes. That I think the one example that they have that was on the soundtrack was actually, it kind of melds in with the Green Lantern theme at the end. So it doesn't feel like it even has its own definition of theme. It's just drums, horns, the synthesizer, and there is some electric guitar that's played in there, but that's not a defining melodic refrain that you're going to remember over and over again, like Batman or Superman or Wonder Woman or even the Green Lantern. So yeah, it is a fine piece. I think the speed defines it as, okay, this is a character that whose skill set is based on his speed. We're going to create a fast paced piece of music here that will accompany that with more percussion and bass driven than it is trying to get somebody to play a whole bunch of notes on a guitar. So I think because of that, it's not going to be one that you return to or remember very easily, but it's interesting. I like the idea behind the composition, if that was the thought process of, we're going to define it by its speed versus its actual melody, which obviously goes well with the character.
Absolutely. And as unsurprisingly, the great work on display from the dynamic music partners on music there. Cal, we will begin to wrap it up for this volume one of this Flash character spotlight. We'll be back, as mentioned, with a volume two, possibly a volume three, based on all of the appearances in season 2 and certainly JLU as well. But for now, we wrap things up here. And we want to thank everyone for listening, whether you do so on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or of course, as mentioned, on the Pod Tower YouTube channel. Head over to youtube.com/thePodTower. You can subscribe to us. Subscribing to us is a great free way to help out our show And you can also leave us a review, give us 5 stars on the podcast apps, give a like to the YouTube videos. We appreciate it. If you'd like to support us more directly in a financial way, there are a couple of ways to do so in the show notes. There's a little donate button where you can just buy us a coffee, throw us a couple bucks. We always appreciate that. It's very, very humbling that anyone would choose to do that, but we always appreciate it. And then, of course, you can also head to our store and pick yourself up a hat or a shirt or a mug or something. Both of those available in the links in the show notes. And Cal, as we continue on to next week, this is technically, believe it or not, still a Superman month. And we will be heading back to Superman, the animated series next week.
That is right, Liam. We are back on track here, as we mentioned at the top, with our finite amount of content left that we haven't already reviewed. We are going to be tackling one of our final new reviews of Superman the Animated Series, and it is the wrapping up of the Bizarro Trilogy, as I would call it. And that is tackling the final encounter that we get, at least on Superman the Animated Series, with Bizarro. But of course, there is a wrinkle, in fact, as we are once again bringing back another recurring character, that being, of course, Mr. Mixia's Spitlick, as we are going to tackle the episode Little Big Head Man. And an episode, again, that I recall seeing quite often, and is probably one of the more comedic episodes that we're going to cover with our remaining content here. So it'll be an interesting one, to say the least.
That's right. Heck of an act to follow with that original Mixie Spitlick episode, which is just indeed one of the most irreverent and bizarre episodes of television that Paul Dini ever wrote, and think of the ground that covers. But we'll definitely look forward to covering that next week, Cal. But until then, I'm Liam.
And I am Cal.
And we'll talk to you next time on another episode of the DCAU Review.
Bye-bye.